WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. What makes surgeons and CEOs worth large salaries and teachers worth comparatively small ones? What do American salaries say about American values? That's the subject of Derek Bok's new book, The Cost of Talent. Bok is the former president of Harvard. He says when he graduated Harvard Law School, salary wasn't a big factor in deciding what job to pursue. The difference between the starting pay at a Wall Street firm and a teacher's salary was only a few hundred dollars. But by the late 80s, law students could earn close to $50,000 more starting at a Wall Street firm than they could teaching. Who can afford not to think about that? In fact, that's what got Bok thinking about salaries and values. He recognizes that there are a lot of legitimate reasons for salary discrepancies.
There are some people who have extraordinary talents. There are some people who have jobs that are unusually hazardous or wearing or difficult. There are some people who can do particular things that are in very short supply. My concern is that the most highly paid professionals in our society are getting two or three times as much as their counterparts abroad, not because of these legitimate market economic reasons, but for cultural reasons and because they often have a lot of discretion over what their own salaries are. And at least during the 80s, they used that flexibility to increase their pay significantly beyond what you would find in other countries like ourselves.
What are the fields or the positions that you consider to be out of whack, to be too high or too low in salary?
Well, I think the whole medical profession receives anywhere from twice to three times what average doctors receive in countries like Canada or France or England or Scandinavia. But then if you break that down and look at, say, what cardiac surgeons are getting, they're averaging somewhere about around $500,000 a year, which is just way above what you would find in other countries. You find in top executives in large corporations salaries that run two, three, four times what they would be for heads of corporations in very successful economies such as Japan. And the same is true with the very successful lawyers. They also make two, three times what successful lawyers would make in countries such as France or Germany or England.
Let's look at professions that have kind of lowered in value if you're just looking at salaries, like teaching, for instance.
Well, teaching has historically been on the low side, and it continues to be relatively poorly paid compared to other countries, if you take account of the fact that we are really the wealthiest country in the world. Another sector that's gone down a lot is public service. From 1970 to 1990, high-level federal career officials probably lost something like 25% of their real income. At the same time that people holding the same jobs that they had in the private sector were going up significantly. And obviously, if that continues, you're going to have a harder and harder time attracting really talented people into the public sector at the very moment that improving the quality of government seems to matter to so many Americans.
Sometimes it seems like people with a lot of money and people whose profession is money are the people who can kind of make more and more money and create huge salaries for themselves.
Well, I think that's one of the worrisome things. Let me just compare two kinds of people with high salaries. Michael Jackson, Michael Jordan, very successful entertainers make huge salaries. But mm-hmm. I have to say this in their defense. They're operating in a very competitive environment. They're bargaining with very strong, knowledgeable organizations. And they still get those high salaries, and they get them because technology has vastly increased and enriched the market for those services, and that's what the market gives them as a reward. If you look at top executives in companies, however, it's rather a different situation as it is for leading surgeons and lawyers. There's no price competition for cardiac surgeons, nobody goes around saying, can you tell me what the lowest priced cardiac surgeon or the lowest priced corporate lawyer or the lowest priced CEO is? Instead, you're not looking for the price of people's services. You're looking for other things, and you're willing to pay pretty much whatever you have to get the person that you want.
Right. Let me reintroduce you. My guest is Derek Bok, former president of Harvard University, and he's written his first book since leaving that position, and it's called The Cost of Talent, How Executives and Professionals Are Paid and How It Affects America. We'll take a short break, then we'll be right back. This is Fresh Air. Derek Bok is my guest, former president of Harvard University, and author of a new book about salaries in America and the values behind those salaries. The book is called The Cost of Talent. I don't know if you'll answer this or not, but how much is a president of Harvard paid?
I don't think there's any standard rate. I know during my 20 years as president of Harvard, I thought it was important that my salary not get too far out of line with those of the faculty members mm-hmm. for one very good reason, not because I'm particularly altruistic, but the job of a leader of a large organization is to try to motivate the people who work with him. And if your salary gets way out of line compared with that of the people that you have to persuade and inspire and lead, then you become a sort of distant person. You may be the object of envy, but in any case, you lose some of your closeness with the people that you need to understand and motivate. So, without going into details, I was certainly reasonably paid, but I was not paid a great deal more than the faculty members that I presided over.
Now, I respect your desire to keep confidential the exact sum that you were paid, but tell me the values behind your wanting to not reveal that. I mean, money is the kind of thing we're all very understandably private about in our culture. But, you know, having just written a book...
Oh, I don't have any particular inhibitions about letting you know. It's just that I'm not sure I can remember it. I mean, it was somewhere in between $150,000 and $175,000, I believe. But it was a matter of public record because under the Freedom of Information Act, mm-hmm. You can petition to receive the salaries of the five highest paid people in an organization, and our student newspaper did that regularly. And I don't think there ever was a year when I was the highest paid person at Harvard, but I don't think that had any, there are some people who feel, well, you know, symbolically the chief executive must get more money than everyone else. I'm not sure it really makes that much a difference. And if there were a few people, particularly in the medical school, who made more than I did, I thought that was much better than my receiving a salary that my faculty colleagues would think was out of line.
Now, how would you deal with the merit versus equality quandary when you were trying to bring a professor to Harvard who other schools were interested in also?
Well, we would... I think if push came to shove, we would do within reason what we had to do to bring them to Harvard. But we would work very hard to keep the differences down to a level where we could justify them. I mean, one of the things I always try to do is to say, if the decision I'm trying to make were to become public and I had to get up in a audience of my peers or a faculty meeting and defend myself, would I feel comfortable about doing so, or would I begin to shake and become incoherent? And when I felt myself shaking and becoming incoherent, I knew I was going down the wrong track and I better rethink the problem. So we tried to keep those differences within the comfort zone, and I think most of the time we were successful. We've never had at Harvard the system of star salaries where, you know, a few exceptionally famous people are paid way more than everybody else. And we've probably lost a few professors because we didn't pay them a star salary, but we feel we gain more than that by creating a greater sense of community solidarity, by maintaining differences that are not so great that they begin to strain the fabric of loyalty and understanding that you want in a community of scholars in order for people to work effectively together.
After having written your book, The Cost of Talent, about salaries in America, are there any things you did that you would have liked to do differently when you were at Harvard?
I think there is one thing I would have liked to work harder at, although we did some of it. I am concerned that institutions like Harvard not make it any more difficult for young people to take low-paying professions that they want to pursue for personal reasons and because they feel they can make a difference to society. And so I think one thing that universities can do is to try to find some way of saying to students that if you have to accumulate educational debts in order to be educated at Harvard, and if you then decide to go into low-paying professions, we will find a way of keeping down your interest repayments or even forgiving them entirely. So you will never run the risk of having to pay more than a certain modest share of your income to repay your debts. We do that in the law school. We've begun to do it in some other schools. I would have liked to push it further and be able to say that there isn't anybody going to Harvard who need shy away from the career they'd like to go into because it doesn't pay enough for them to repay their educational debts.
At the end of your book, you quote an old adage that basically says you should be careful of what you're worshiping because you become what you worship.
Mm-hmm.
How does that apply to salaries?
Well, one of the things that struck me is that the salaries for successful professionals and managers, as I say, are not really determined by market processes. They're much more subject to discretion. And that discretion is shaped and influenced and informed by the values of the society. And those values change. It's not an accident, I think, that there are only two decades since World War I in which chief executive officers saw their compensation rise substantially faster than that of other working men and women. Those two decades were the 1920s and the 1980s. And I think we all know that there was something different about the 1920s and 1980s. Those were decades in which making money was unusually celebrated, and those who made a lot of money got a lot of applause and notice as a result. So I think values are important. They do have a real influence on the kind of, just as I think our values have a lot of influence with what our school teachers get paid and our public servants. So that in the end, one can talk about remedies, one can talk about whether Congress can do something or whether we can impose new rules. But and there are some things that you can do which will avoid these extremes in compensation. But in the end, I think we have to recognize that the compensation in our society is a function of values. We've got to face up to that and think about whether those are the values we really want to have. And I think it's only when we do that and we recognize that compensation is important, but it isn't the only way we keep score in life. And to get grotesque salaries is really probably not the way to happiness or welfare or a better society. And only when we see that, I think, will we return to decades in the past when the salaries of our most successful members have gone up at rates much more in keeping with those of other working people in the society.
I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Derek Bok is the former president of Harvard and the author of the new book, The Cost of Talent. This is Fresh Air.